accession number 27083, reel 69.
You were not aware the Prime Minister wished to sack you, but in one sense, would it not have been quite a good idea to have been dismissed, because then you could have told the whole truth and had a magnificent, but you'd have certainly had a field day being able to put the full case, the Navy's full case, without restraint?
I think it was too late for that. The die had been cast. And whereas some period of time before, say around the time of the Falklands, the middle of 82, I think even then the writing was sufficiently deeply embedded in the stonework that it would have been a fatuous gesture. And in any event, as a result of my IOSI lecture, I had virtually revealed the truth.
But not to a wide audience, though?
No, though the press in particular picked it up. And most people read one newspaper or another. Not all of them, it was men of the broadsheets that did their thing.
Yes, yes. Then if we may, Sir Henry, can we... I've got one or two questions that really go back to the Falklands, I'm afraid.
Yes.
Which, of course, stem from where we left things last time. Some of them you've dealt with fine, which was assistance from the US and the backseat driving point I wanted to raise. You've very succinctly covered those. You also covered the operation of journalists question. You mentioned South Georgia and Goose Green.
Yes.
I just want to ask you about the operation of journalists, because there was at the time tremendous criticism of the MOD and that poor man whose name might have been McDonald or something similar to that.
Indeed, it was McDonald. I knew him very well.
Who had this terrible delivery spoke at the speed of a Dalek or something, and the handling one felt, or the impression was given at the time that the handling of whilst Britain won the war, as usual, it lost the publicity war. I just wondered whether what your views are, both then in the Falklands and generally, for example, in the most recent Gulf War that we've just had last year, as to what the role of journalists should be and how they should be, to use the modern phrase, embedded or attached with armed forces, because you have this tremendous dichotomy between, on the one hand, trying to, obviously, they wish to get the story back to their readers, and that can easily conflict with your desire, quite correctly, for operational secrecy.
Yes. It's a very good point. I go back to my time as, certainly my time as fleet commander, and I think actually probably to my time as flag officer first flotilla, where I'd had not inconsiderable dealings with the press. And who was that chap on the Daily Express? I'd had a number of dealings with him. In fact, he appeared to have followed me around my...
We haven't said his name. It was Chapman Pincher.
This is Chapman Pincher of the Express?
Yes, he was on the Express. He was an old Beaverbrook man.
Yes.
Been there since Beaverbrook's day.
Well, he wrote all sorts of things about me. I came to know him quite well. He used to ask me fishing, but he only did so when I had reached a position that mattered. Until you mattered, you weren't fair game for him. And he was a curious man. He had two topics of conversation. One was fishing, and the other was spies. And that about was the end of the message. But I had thought, I thought about the media, and I knew that we had got it wrong. By we, I mean we, the MOD, or we, the services. And it's a tricky one. We were entering the era of satellite communications, near real time, totally secure, worldwide coverage. This was an enormous advance, no question about it. It was technically, it was a huge element of progress, which was not matched by people that should really have given much more thought to the part likely to be played by the media in any future conflict. And it hadn't been thought. And that was a mixture. It was partly the fault of the services, and it was partly the fault of the media themselves, of whatever form it took, be it TV or press. I think that on the from the media's viewpoint, they argued that they, to be cost-effective, they had relatively high-priced journalists, can I use the term generically, reporters, who had to cover the day-to-day news and so forth, and simply to be present during a pre-planned exercise of one or other of the services wasn't really big news and wouldn't hit the public much. And they had a point, because it wasn't really of particular interest unless there was some more or less startling element that hadn't been done before, or of course if it was a disaster like a collision or an explosion or somebody being killed, that was a different situation. Then it was news in the ordinary sense of the term, but otherwise not. So one can see that editors were reluctant. Indeed, they were positively against releasing their reporting talent for such purposes. As a result, they didn't. As a result, the services were themselves not used to dealing with the media under such, under, in terms of peace, exercise conditions. And the fault lay on both sides. I think that the fault, I'll leave it like that, because although you can say, well, the services could have put up various, call them servers, call them whatever, drawn from their own service, who would have and perhaps artificially raised difficulties to test out the relationship, and of course this goes back to security considerations and so forth in the course of the exercise. But be that as it may, and I'm not sure it would have got very far, because a put-up reporter like that is not the same animal as a real reporter. Anyway, it wasn't done. And I pressed very hard to get this done on various occasions. A national exercise, there was this annual thing called Wintex, which was a major strategic exercise involving NATO and so forth, and the any reporting that might have been done after it was over was so bland and so trivial, really, that it was only half a boring column, and everybody turned the page over. Now, this, for lack of testing, lack of training, lack of mutual understanding and cooperation, was starkly evident during the Falklands War. I think that was the first occasion that it really was so. And it was due, because it was, after all, as I mentioned earlier, it was the first war fought by us which incorporated satellite communications. And I know it presented difficulties. Eventually, some modus operandi was reached, but it was on a pretty ad hoc basis, and it wasn't entirely satisfactory. And there were breaches, of which I've already quoted one, which I won't repeat. And when a breach occurred, it led to an exacerbation of the, as it were, inherent feeling of distrust between the service officer and the media reporter. Inevitably, I think. Then there was the other aspect, which again I've touched on earlier, where I disobeyed the rules, which virtually precluded my having contact with the media. And out of desperation, I largely ignored that and was prepared to parcel out various bits of information, which certainly was no harm to security, and might have been, if properly played, might have been helpful to the Navy's case, and well, the rest I think I've already explained. And that didn't always work out because it got turned upside down in the course of an issue by the media and so on. And I think I better stop there because I simply do not know, having now been out of it, out of the front line for 22 years, I don't know whether the extent to which things have improved, if they have. I hope they have. You mentioned the name MacDonald just now. I knew him very well. He was a perfectly nice man. But he was not the right man for that particular job. And when he had bad news to promulgate, he assumed, rather like the naval parade training manual has for your demeanor at a funeral, that you assume an aspect cheerful but subdued. Well, he was subdued par excellence, and there was no cheerfulness about it at all. To the point that, and I think you know all this, whenever he appeared on the scene to make an announcement, wives back home used to rush for their televisions and switch them off. They couldn't bear it, and so on. And he got changed. He was a bad choice, and it wasn't his fault. He played it. He just exposed his feelings, and he wasn't the right man for the job.
Right.
That took me a long time, I'm afraid. But it's a very important matter. And I meant it when I said I sincerely hope that it's got better. Of course, I remember being rung up by who's the man who writes feature articles in the Times? Jenkins?
Simon Jenkins.
Simon Jenkins, yeah. I forget whether it was him or who it was. But it was someone, and I'd got I don't think it was him, actually. It was somebody that had acquired a sort of a reasonable liaison with at the time of the start, almost before it had started, the Falklands War. And the powers that be, and that wasn't me, had decided that some very small number, it was like, it was half a dozen or less, I think, of reporters, I'll use the term generically, which would include a TV camera and so forth, were to sail with the task force. And people, this chap rang me up and said, couldn't he send another one, and what about it? And so forth. It wasn't within my jurisdiction at all. And I took his point and I said, well, you know, you had to play this one separately. And eventually it got sorted out. And the numbers were substantially increased. again, nobody had thought this through. And the reason they hadn't thought it through was because they never exercised it in peacetime practices. So there are, I just hope we're better.
Thank you. The next point I'd like to ask you, which we never touched on, I never asked this question in the context of the Belgrano, was what were your views and what were your personal views and your professional views on the 200-mile exclusion zone, which did seem rather artificial. Why you should... I know 200 miles is the sort of territorial limit and all that sort of thing, so that's probably the origin of the 200 miles itself. But if you're going to be at war with a country, especially Argentina, which are only 250 or 300 miles away, or whatever they are, the mainland, surely you just say there is an exclusion zone that goes from Ushuaia to the top of the Argentinian coast. And say, if you know, if your naval ships put to sea more than 3 miles, we'll sink them. Would that not have been better?
Well, your question really is not without analogy to what is the length of a piece of string. It might have been better. I don't personally think that it would have been. I think that it was deliberately kept to what might be describable, I think, as the minimum viable limits. Partly for reasons of the wider the area that you declare, the greater the number of antidotes, in this case ships, to cover that area. And we didn't have a surfeit of ships down there, and so on. So these were all considerations. I think they got it about right. It's pretty academic. It's an important element because the last thing you want to do in a war or a potential war situation is to indulge in bluff. You can indulge in deception, that's a different thing altogether, but not bluff. And so, for example, you take the case of the National Independent Strategic Nuclear Deterrent. You could say you have improved Polaris without actually having done so. Sooner or later, the information would escape and so forth. And you're playing with fire. And although you might achieve considerable success for a period of time, it won't last forever, and it's a very dangerous instrument to play with, in my view. And I think the same applies only to a considerably lesser extent to the precise dimensions of the exclusion or whatever zones. And if you said, supposing you put it out at 300 miles so that they couldn't really leave their home ports, clearly that would have been absurd, and we couldn't have implemented it, and they would have known that, whereas what we did apply, which even so was barely implementable, was much closer to the reality.
So the 200 mile zone was really based on what your appreciation was of the Navy's ability to enforce it.
Yes.
And that's how it came about.
That was a major factor in it, yes.
Right. Did the original idea for it come from you or from the politicians?
I don't know. But I brought up my team at Northford when I was the fleet commander to deal with this sort of thing. And if you talk to any of the COs of the ships out there in either the task group or later that came as escorts and so forth that had been at Northwood, and they recognised that that stamp, as it were.
Yes. My next question really is a sort of has two sides to it, really. On the one hand, I'm going to ask you for your professional judgment as to how close you felt the exercise came to disaster, if at all, or if it did, how often?
This is the Falklands?
Yes.
Yep.
And secondly, from my personal point of view, having done really no more than read Simon Jenkins's, who we've mentioned, Simon Jenkins's book that he wrote with mm-hmm. Max Hastings.
Yes.
So that one gets an appreciation of, if you like, what happened on the ground there. The Argentine conduct of the war seemed to be grossly incompetent almost from start to finish, and that, not to put too fine a point on, if we'd been fighting a real enemy like the Germans or somebody who do things properly, the outcome could have been quite different. Do you think they were incompetent? And dealing with the second question first,
I think there were instances of both. There were some occasions on which they defended their positions very vigorously and skillfully and effectively, and they were tough nuts to crack. There were others where they gave in almost once, and it was something of a walkover. The climatic conditions, the terrain, and so forth were in favor of the defenders rather than the attackers. The fact that we had to rely on a strictly limited number, and there were none others available, of sea harriers to deal with the air threat, quite apart from anti-aircraft capabilities both ashore and in ships, meant that that was an edgy and an unbalanced situation, unbalanced significantly in favor of the Argentine. To that extent, it was fairly hairy. I've already mentioned the fact that I was never questioned about probable losses that I had. I would have been prepared to have carry on with losses double the size that they were. I'm talking now in terms of ships. But and I won't rehearse all that again. The question of the carriers was a virtually impossible one, sensibly, to assess because of the number of variables involved. I think that one has read critics say, and John Knott was one shortly afterwards, that mileage should not be made of the Falklands War because that was unique, it was a one-off, it would never recur, and so on. And yet, here we are now in a situation in Iraq. We've been in other situations, or contributed to other situations in Bosnia and Kosovo and all that. Not the same. You can say they're all one-offs. But they're not exactly without relevance, and so on. So, I don't know that I can answer your question any better. Does that satisfy you at all?
Yeah, well, I understand how you're trying to answer the question, yes. One minor point that when I was with Michael Beetham, he recounted his hearing that hearing the news that the Atlantic conveyor had been hit,
mm-hmm.
and he realised what the consequences were for the airlift and the loss of the Chinook helicopters and all that stuff.
Yeah,
and he was horrified to learn. At the same time that he wanted to know where the carriers were, and he was horrified to learn that the Invincible was just round the corner, that it was very close to where to the Atlantic conveyor. I think I'm correct in saying that's what he said. Obviously, the intention was to keep the carriers out of sight, but out of harm's way as much as possible, but clearly...
Oh, that is very much the case. I think he must have got hold of the wrong end of the stick with that, because I think if you talk to senior soldiers who were involved in the land force, they were accustomed to the ultimate boss, the commanding general, visiting them on the front line from time to time. This was a great morale boost. And this was not done ever by Admiral Sandy Woodward. And in my judgment, he was absolutely correct in not doing it. Because if he'd been caught for sure, one way or another, and unable to get back, he could no longer stand back and view the thing overall, which he did. And he knew the risks involved, and he knew his biggest dilemma was how far off to stand, because the further he stood off, the safer his carriers would be, but the longer was the flight time to the target, and the greater, really, the reaction time in combating incoming aerial attack, and so on. And these were quite tricky decisions for him to take. In my view, again, absolutely correctly, he erred, if he erred at all, he erred on the side of keeping too far away rather than too close in. So I think that Michael Beaton was talking Codswallop and saying she was just round the corner.
Yeah, that was my expression, but I got the impression from him that
no, she never went.
The Invincible was reasonably close.
No, she was never just round the corner.
Right.
For just that reason.
Yes.
She was invaluable and irreplaceable.
Yes.
We had nothing else up our sleeves, eh? Because Illustrious was, although we expedited her being brought forward on completion of building, but she never made it in time.
Thank you. I'd just like to touch on one thing. Can you describe, please, for me, the mechanics and procedure of the relationship between the CDS, yourself, and Admiral Fieldhouse, the CNC fleet? Is it the case that you effectively, how should I put it, draft the operational orders, if that's the correct phrase, which go to Admiral Fieldhouse and he executes them? They go to Admiral Fieldhouse and he then executes them. In other words, you don't have any further involvement. You say, you give him operational orders and then he just proceeds from there.
That was how it started, because the Chief of Defence Staff was out in New Zealand. And I was not even acting Chief of Defence, that was the Chief of the Air Staff. And it was just how it developed, in that having gone that fateful Wednesday night, the 31st of March or whatever it was, into the Prime Minister's room, in fact to see John Knott, but then got caught up with the whole shooting match. And I took it from there until such time as Admiral Lewin came back, which was, I forget exactly when, two or three days later, sort of thing. Once he was back, then I virtually was out of it, because it was the Prime Minister formed this very small war cabinet, invariably attended by the Chief of the Defence Staff. Initially, the plan was that it would be attended by the Chiefs of Staff. That was then regarded as too cumbersome, and anyway they were hardly involved, and so they were simply it was simply attended by the Chief of the Defence Staff. And I can remember having feeling a bit miffed at this, because Admiral Lewin had been CDS for 18 months or so by then, and wasn't absolutely bang up to date on detailed naval matters as hopefully was the First Sea Lord. And I represented this to Clive Whitmore, the Prime Minister's private secretary.
Private secretary.
But again, I think the Prime Minister preferred to deal with one man than with two or three or four, or whatever. So that's how it went.
So you had to brief the CDS all the time?
Really? I had to brief CDS all the time. But in terms of taking it further, going into the War Cabinet, talking direct to the Prime Minister, and issuing instructions to John Fieldhurst, the fleet commander, who was the task force commander, even though he was back in England, whereas Sandy Wood was the task group commander, next one down. That was the Chief of Defence Staff, Admiral Lynn.
Right. And after a hiccup, it started to work well. You said you felt slightly miffed by it. Did it work well?
There wasn't a hiccup. I was anxious that there shouldn't be, afraid that there might be. But that's the way it went. No, there wasn't a hiccup.
Good. Good.